Welcome to the Board Game Barbecue, a virtual community, a physical community, and a podcast over 100 episodes strong. If you would like to join our community, find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Discord, or YouTube, and keep your eye out for events we run all across Australia at regular intervals and also for online events. A big thank you to our sponsors and patrons for your support. This wouldn't be possible without you. But now it's time for the podcast. Kick back, relax, and enjoy the barbecue. The Board Game Barbecue, brought to you by Addicts, Not Experts. Hello and welcome to the Board Game Barbecue Podcast, episode 104. Today it's the old guard, except for Dan, of course, not the old guard.
Not the oldest guard.
That's right. But we've got two of the wisest folks out there. We've got Mitch and Def. How are we going, guys?
Yeah, I'm going all right. We're the two wisest guys. I'm not sure
they've turned up yet. Yeah, I'm keen to understand.
Have we got guests coming on we don't know about?
Oh, come on, don't beat yourselves up, please. Mitch, you're so wise. You avoid confrontation by playing all your games by yourself. And
exactly.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Well, that 5 years in the pen that after I played the last, you know, competitive game cost me, so no more.
Don't tell stories like this, Mitch. We had people thinking you were a fireman for like 6 months. Welcome to the show. Today we are doing our usual show, so there'll be sizzling segment coming up next. Then we're doing our topic, which is going to be all about theme in games, followed by the board game barbecue bracket battle and into swearing an oath. So no better place to start than with sizzling games. I'm going to go to Def. Def, what's been sizzling?
Well, just looking at my list here, it's an interesting one because I've been playing lately. I've been playing most games on repeat instead of, you know, playing new games every day. My brain seems to like repetition. So there's a couple of games I've been playing quite a lot the past few days, but I think I can't look past Too Many Bones, which I've played almost on a daily basis for the last 3 or 4 weeks, which is hectic. A lot. It's a lot.
Because that game only goes for 10 or 15 minutes, so I'm sure you can like crack off heaps of those, right?
I'm just wondering, before we go any further here, I made this comment before when Def was talking about this. Has Def now played this more than you, Mitch?
I'm pretty sure he has. Yep.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'd have to go back. I've had it for a couple of years, but yeah. Well, see, I don't track all of my plays, so I can't exactly know how many I've got. But I think, did you say you'd played it 18 times in the last week or something? Or 2 weeks?
18 times, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be past. I'd be surprised if I was more than 15.
But I've only explored part of it because I've only played two of the initial gear locks. I haven't touched the other two yet because as long as I kept getting, you know, satisfaction out of playing with the ones I've picked, then I keep doing that. And then when I get bored and want to move on, then I'll have fresh content.
Mm. I believe you've got fresh content on the way too, don't you, in the mail?
Yeah, I know. It's surprisingly not the most I've spent on a single purchase, but it was damn close. So, yeah, this is something I didn't think I would play this much, to be honest. I've found lately that my tastes are not changing, but they're adjusting, I'd say. Before, you know, a game would have to be a Euro classic, Euro approach, and I do like games having a bit of theme to tie to our topic, but it didn't really mind, you know, cube pushing and meeples being placed and
resources
and stuff would be all that was required. But I'm finding lately that if a game has a good design, it doesn't matter what category it falls under. And the best couple of examples I can think about around this is one's Too Many Bones and the other one is D-Day the Dice Game. Because these are very, you know, these are games that would fall under my usual preference. They've got a lot of dice rolling. They've got a lot of lose actions, you know, you lose things, you lose soldiers or you lose health, you lose, you know, it's a combat games and things like that.
And you can lose the game. It's not just
and
about
you can lose the game as well, yeah.
Scoring good or scoring bad. It's like, and some, like, scoring is not even a factor. You don't get a score in too many bones.
Yeah, and D-Day of the Dice is the same. But coming back to too many bones, it's been really interesting to, I guess, discover the unique design it has behind it. And this is why, you know, I've decided to spend even more money to get additional content, because it is something that I think is quite unique, both in terms of the way they've created that world, because they went into a lot of trouble and work to create that world. But it's not a game that the theme comes out, you know, you there's a lot of world building, but there's no narrative. There's little bit, but not, it's not a campaign game. It doesn't have a coherent story or anything like that. But the effort that has gone into creating that world and the characters really comes out when you start playing with them in repetition, like I have. So I've now identified with Patches and Boomer, which I've been playing, and I talk to them as if they're, you know, they're in the party and I'm there. And, you know, I message you, Mitch, or Adrian or Sarah sometimes, and I go, Boomer did this and that, and that, you know, lazy bastard Patches didn't follow through and whatever else. And I think that's where all the game is. It is around the development of the individual characters. And it was actually a bit of a bumpy start for me, because when I played it for the first couple of times, I tried it completely solo, so that means just with one character. And when you play that game solo, it's very hard to get by without focusing on your basic stats, so your health, your attack, your defense, and your dexterity. And so I had a couple of games and all I did was rolling attack and defense die mostly, and I was like, not entirely sure I'm gonna like this. And then as soon as I put two characters together, that's where the whole kind of game opened up, and you can start adding their special skills and see how they work together. And there's a lot of rules in the game, like there's a lot of things that you can miss, but the investment for me has been really worth it, because I've had some really rewarding game sessions and moments as well, you know, losing or winning an encounter, or the whole game, even at the last turn of the last round. It's been really, really useful for me to go through that, because, as I said before, it's not a game I would think I'd enjoy usually a few months ago.
I have a bit of a story on Too Many Bones, because Brad took Too Many Bones to the game day yesterday. And had a teach set up, and he wanted to just have a game beforehand, just to get into the groove of it, you know, to get refresh himself with everything. Yeah, a bit of a refresher. And he asked me to take if he could take Duster and Stanza from Undertow, because he wanted to try out Stanza. He wanted to have a look at that, and, you know, and given that he would be playing with a bunch of other new people, he thought it'd be an opportunity for him to learn Stanza and have a go of her. And so we did that. We took them along. And he spent 2 hours playing with Dan, who was Dan's first time playing as well, and playing Stanza. And they had their two-hour game, and then he had to do his teach that he had scheduled in. And I asked him, I said to him, so how was Stanza? And he was like, oh, man, there is so much going with Stanza. It's like another level again. He's like, I'm not playing her in the teach because it's just so much to understand. So you've only just done, you know, Patches and Boomer, and then you've still got to get through Picket and Tantrum in the base game, and then from what Brad's now telling us with Undertow, there's a whole nother level again, and complexity that just steps up with Stanza. So there's just so much there to unlock and to work on. And I think you said before in terms of the narrative and the campaign game. I agree with you there. I think that's probably one of the sort of shortcomings of the base game, at least, is that the story really is just stitched on, and it doesn't really, even when you're playing through the event cards, they don't go together seamlessly, sort of sequentially. They can be a little bit out of whack. And I believe that there's one of the expansions on, it's either 40 Days in Daylor or, I can't remember the other, Age of Tyranny. One of those two, I think, adds a campaign mode where I believe the story is a bit better.
Yeah, but I have to say, it hasn't bothered me, right? I'll be very honest, after those first few games, even after I started playing with two characters, I thought, well, there's a limited amount of bad guys, of monsters in the game, and you go through them after a couple of games, you go through quite a few of them, and I thought, I'm going to get bored of this because I don't see how this is going to hold my attention or interest long term. And here I am planning almost on a daily basis with the same two characters. I haven't even changed the characters yet. And I think that's a testament to the depth the character development has in the game. And that is more like a puzzle kind of thing rather than character development in the traditional way we meet it in, games, that have a lot of theme or dungeon crawlers or whatever. It's more around how you can make those skills work for you in every battle with the bad guys that you have across the mat from you, rather than, growing your character.
Or building a story.
So it hasn't bothered me at all at this stage. It's been really, really good so far. So this is why I've been a bit keen to support Chip Theory Games because of the uniqueness in the game. I really want to, get behind companies that do unique things.
Yeah. And how many of the different tyrants have you played against?
I've played, I think, four or five by now. So I've kind of took them in a order of short to long game. So you can play, Gnome at first, which is a pretty quick game, and then you can ramp it up with the others. And some of them I got really stuck with and started cursing at them randomly or walking by the box and cursing at the box. So it's been good. And again, have the same, the concern that, if the tyrants ran out, there's like eight of them in the base game, I might, do I really want to keep playing this? But then, as I said, the whole game is around the characters, so I'm pretty sure swapping even just one character with Pickett or Tantrum is going to...
Yeah, create a whole different dynamic
create a whole for different all the experience. Different tyrants. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the last thing I wanted to say is that it's a very... It escalates... very well, and I don't mean that from a scale point of view, but from a difficulty and rewards point of view. So Patches is pretty straightforward to play because his skills are pretty simple, and then Boomer is a notch up from that because she creates bombs and sends them flying around, and then I had a read of the other two guys and they are on two scales above that, where it's like a completely different thing. It's very, the skills are very intricate, connected between them. They're more complex. So that gives me, the satisfaction that I can keep learning along with the game, and the game will still have a lot to offer when I know it well enough or when I have surpassed that threshold of, I've played Patches and Boomer so long, now I know them like the back of my hand, and
So, and then once you'll get to the point where you'll switch to Pickett and
Tantrum,
and you'll get to know them, but then you'll be able to put Boomer with Tantrum,
yeah,
and exactly. it's a whole new dynamic, yeah.
I wasn't looking forward to this. I've had too many bones in that Aetherworks cart at least 17 times since the retreat.
Yep.
I didn't even get to play it at the retreat, but I've only played it once before with Shane, and I really enjoyed it. And I'm like, just like umming and ahhing, and I'm like, it's probably time. It's probably time to get out the purchase pen and give it a shot.
Yeah, there you go.
It sounds like too much fun.
And if you don't like it, you can use it as a raft.
That's true.
Because it all floats.
Yes, that's true. That's right.
Well, it's going
up to the beach with all the tantrum, the mats and everything all over
mats,
me.
Mats.
very good. All right. Well, that was too many bones. Nice one. I'm going to go next, actually, because I'm going to sizzle the oldest game anyone's sizzled on our show.
Oh.
Yep. And that is Crokinole.
Right. Yeah.
Crokinole, or whatever you want to call it.
As Sarah would call it.
So I had a chance to play this a few times, actually. I had a chance to play it with Dave and Dan at BrizCon. So that's the guys from 2D6 that were at BrizCon. And, hey, what better time to announce the fact that 2D6 is sponsoring the sizzling segment and giving away a whole big Marvel Champions bundle. So if you want that, go to our Facebook page, find the relevant post, and come up with an awesome superhero name for Dave and Dan. There's been some special ones, even ones where there's spelling mistakes have made them even better than they previously were. I'll just say this.
But were they mistakes?
Dice Master Dan was missing an E in a very crucial moment. Either way, so there's, jump on there and jump into that competition. But I'll go back to my Crokinole story. So I played it there the first time, and a really nice table, really well-waxed table, and you just flick these discs and they go flying, and you're like, it was a real art form to try and make it stop in the right place. And then the next time I played it was on a different board, and I'm guessing it hadn't been waxed in as recently as the other table, because the cadence was so different. You'd flick these discs at the same speed as on the other one, and they'd go like 5 centimeters. And that was a waste.
You got to recalibrate your finger.
Yeah, that's right. But I actually got to play this at the game day in Sydney on the weekend as well. I got to play it with Mike, actually, so it was quite nice. We both had teachers all day, and it was nice just to have time for the two of us to have a go. We picked the perfect time too, when everyone started packing up. We thought we'd just crack in and have a game of Crokinole right then. But what was interesting is the game is a pretty straightforward game. It's like anyone can play it. It's a round table. You have this little wedge that you can only hit from. If there's none of your opponent's discs on the table, you must have your disc end up in the middle ring, and the ring is surrounded by these little bumpers that make it hard to get in there. But if your opponent does have a disc on the board, no matter where it is on the board, you need to be able to hit that disc on your shot. Otherwise, yours doesn't count. So it kind of is like an in-off kind of thing. And that's pretty much it. Then there's like scoring and whatever else. But essentially, that's all you're trying to do is flick these discs to either get them in the middle or to try and knock out your opponents. And we played the first round, Mike and I, and it was the first time I'd played it where I played multiple rounds. Like, I think I played 2 or 3 rounds in previous ones, but this was, I think we played 5 rounds with Mike and I. And the scoring is really odd. It's first to 100, but it's not, oh, I'm on 100, you're on 85. It's, okay, you scored 20, I scored 10, which means you're 10 points in front of me, so you're on 10. So getting to 100means you need to be 100 in front. Yeah. Yeah, so it's instead of like if I had a bad round and I was on 60 and Mike scored 25, then I would come back to 35.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so it was a bit interesting. It's a bit interesting that, because it means that you play for a long time. But what made it fun, the game itself is quite addictive, because you feel like an idiot half the time and you feel like a genius the other half of the time. After we played the first round and I explained all the rules to Mike and we'd had a bit of fun, from the second round on, the sledging just went next level. It was just the best. It was like, you wouldn't be able to hit that if your life depended on it. There was other words that were said than that, but like, just constant banter, and it was just, it's just two people sitting across a table from each other having a good time. So it had always interested me playing this game because it, you know, it's a game that was released in, like, I think it's 1870 or something, and it's still in the BGG top 100, which is bizarre.
Phenomenal, yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't know when I was going to get the chance, but all of a sudden, all these people I know have Crokinole boards now. So it was really cool. So yeah, bit of a strange one, but that's my sizzle for the week.
Hmm.
That's awesome.
Much to add to that, except that it's fantastic. It's heaps of fun, but
it sounds like also the quality and the make of the board and whatever else, you know, influences how you play it tremendously. Which means that you might be an expert on a specific table, and then you know nothing in the next one, which might make it a very different, you know, game every time. Which actually sounds good, you know.
It's true, Def, because the first board I played on was the really smooth one, the recently waxed one. But the little pegs that go around to block the middle, they were just like dowel, like wooden dowel, right? But then on the other boards I've played, those were like rubber.
Oh, so they would flick things back.
And bounce so much faster. Yeah.
Okay.
I've had that experience. You sort of just, you just nick those little nodules and pew! Your thing goes flying off like the other direction. It's like it's almost like pinball feeling.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
When you hit one of those bumpers.
The things that it reminded me of, were like pinball, were like air hockey, even a bit of pool, like, or a bit of billiards where you got to sort of go in off and all that. It had all those tropes, but it was just, you know, in a sitting on a bar table, you know, a meter away from your opponent and just having a good laugh. So it was loads of fun. And I managed to get in one round, I got two in a row into the hole in the middle.
Which is the highest score, right?
Yeah, it's 20 points, and you just put it aside. It's a guaranteed 20 points. You can't lose it. So I got 40 points just from that turn, which was pretty
good. Is the table a standard size, or do you have tables of different sizes around in the market, or does it need to be like, you know, a standard size to be proper?
I believe it's a standard size, but the design of the boards, that's where the structure stops. I've seen people who have these as a clock on their wall. So what they do is where the center hole is, they'll pull the clock out. They'll put a clock in there and stick it on their wall, so it's an analog clock. And when they go to play it, they'll pull the clock section out. And then
take the
put
board
it on
down.
The table, and away they go. Like, how cool is that? But I mean, you could spend like a good Crokinole board, and I mean good. That one I played on, I think it was like $300-$350, right? The one I played on at the game day, I don't even think it's that expensive. I think it's like $180 or something like that. But you can, if you go onto like eBay and type in Crokinole boards, you can pay in the thousands if you want to. it's
crazy.
Yeah, you can get something, but it's because of the way it's made or the type of wood it's used or the artwork that's on it. But, yeah, I mean, in the end, I just want to flick discs into a hole, which sounds a bit weird. But anyway.
That sounds like great fun, actually.
Right? It's going to be fun.
Yeah. All right, well, that was Crokinole. I'll go over to Mitch.
Okay, so my sizzling game, I actually didn't play a whole lot of new games or anything at the game day, and I didn't really even play any big games. I sort of just bounced around and did little bits and pieces here and there. But one game that I've played a few times over the last week since it arrived as a new delivery to my place is a little card game called Lawyer Up.
Oh, I've got this. I haven't opened it yet. I got it on Friday before I flew down, so I'm very keen to hear this.
Yeah, so Lawyer Up by Rock Manor Games, which is a two-player game where it's set in a courthouse and there's different trials and different cases that you can do. And you play – it's a competitive game, 1v1, and one of you are the prosecution and the other are the defense. And you do the setup as per the particular case that you've chosen to do. So there'll be a number of witnesses that come out. Half will be on the defense side and half will be on the prosecution side. You divvy up a set of cards. You each start with a base set of cards for the prosecution and the defense. And then based on that case that you're doing, you do a section, what they call the discovery phase, and there's a little bit of card drafting in it. So you essentially go through the deck six cards at a time, three each. You look at those three cards. You'll choose one to keep for yourself, one that you have to give to your opponent, and one that you can bury. So you're looking at these evidence cards that you're going to use doing your arguments, and trying to, you know, you have that drafting. But to me, it was kind of cool because it's a bit slightly different. You're not just picking one that you want and then handing the others to the other player to choose from. You're actually choosing one to go to them. Mm. So you're trying to choose the worst one to go to them. But then you're also kind of like, well, and then you get the opportunity to just get rid of one entirely. So you can sort of say one, that's really good for them, does nothing for me, so I'm going to just, you know, toss that one. So you go through the case cards, you go through those, you divvy those up. And then to the side of the game, you have 12 cards that represent each juror. And each juror has a number from 1 to 6. And each juror has on it what is effectively a track, and there's four spaces on each of those tracks. Two of those spaces are the defense side, and two of those spaces are the prosecution side. And then each of those cards for each juror has a little marker that, you know, you use to track along that track where that juror is leaning towards.
It's like a tug of war.
It's like 12 little tug of wars, right? Because each one of those has its own track. And that's the objective of the game, is the winner is the person who, at the end of the trial, once all the witnesses have been questioned, who has the most jurors leaning towards their side.
That's so cool.
Right? So, and the other sort of curly part that goes into it is, as I said, each has a number on it from 1 to 6. There's actually two of each number. So there's 2 ones, 2 twos, 2 threes, 2 fours, 2 fives, 2 sixes. And you, in order to sway that jury member one space, it will cost you that much influence per jury member. So the jurors that are ones are easy. They flip back and forth between defense and prosecution pretty easily.
That is so cool, though. That is awesome.
Yeah. And then there's the sixth juror, the ones with the six value on them. They are super hard to get them to move because it's cost quite a bit of money. So that's at a high level what you're sort of trying to do. And the way you do that is you then have you take turns calling witnesses, and the witness will come out. And the witnesses will have a starting value on each side of their card. So no one can see this, so it's kind of hard to show it. I was going to say, I'll pull the cards out and I'll just show you, but obviously can't do that. So on each side, they have a series of symbols, and you rotate the card sideways so that your opponent is seeing one set of symbols and you're seeing another set of symbols. At the start, they're both the same, but you get a different starting influence. So each witness, so if you call a prosecution's witness, the prosecution's influence on that side of the card will probably be the highest. So the prosecution starts with a slight advantage. And then you draw 5 cards from your deck. And in order to play a card to the witness, which is like questioning or presenting evidence or whatever it may be, or making an argument, the card you call from your hand will have a matching or a set of symbols at the top of it. You have to have a symbol that matches the symbol on the side of the witness in order to play that card down. And then your subsequent cards after that will have to match the symbols that were on the card before it. So it's almost a bit of set collection and set matching as you go. And each time you play a card, there will be a couple of things. One, there's an amount of influence on it. So you add that up as you go to work out, you know, how much you're influencing the witness or the jury as you go. And you take turns with your opponent. So they will play their influence on the opposite side of the card. So they're going up and you're going up at the same time. You continue doing that until both of you either have run out of cards in your hand, so you don't have any more to play, or you've chosen to pass. And once you choose to pass, you're out, and then the other person can continue to play until they pass. Once you both pass, you tally up your total amount of influence that you've earned, and one of you will be higher than the other, and that person wins that witness. So they'll take that witness card. There's usually a victory bonus. So if you win that, there'll be a victory condition that will say move 2 biases of the jury members. So you can pick any 2 jury members. and move them one space on their bias track. Or it might say the bias tracks tokens that you have on your jury, that they each have their own symbol. So it might say move one spot bias for one of the skull jury members. Mm. And so you can only move the ones that are the skull. So that might be an opportunity when you go, oh, look, the skull's one of the six members. So that's a really valuable card because I can move that juror that's going to cost me six to move it. So that's the first thing you can do in terms of moving jury members. And then so once you've actioned the victory conditions on the witness, you then tally up your amount of influence you've got. Say, for example, I scored 12 death and you scored 8,
mm.
right? You lost, but that doesn't mean I get to spend all 12 of my influence. I only get to spend the difference between you and I. So that'll only give me 4 influence. So, you know, I may not even have enough. Well, at 4, I wouldn't be able to sway anyone that was 5 or higher in the jury. Mm-hmm. So, I can only swing those little ones that are sort of moving back and forth quite regularly. So even when you're on the losing side, even if you're going through and you know, okay, this is a prosecution witness and I'm on the defense and, you know, they start with a huge amount of influence and it's really hard to catch up, there's still an incentive to keep playing to stay close, because if you just pack it in and go, oh, well, yeah, I'm going to lose this witness anyway, well, then they have a huge gap between you and them. But if you can just try and get close and close a gap, well, then you reduce the amount of influence that they get to spend at the end of the round when they win. So, pardon me. So, yes, it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. There's a lot going on. There's some other things you can do as well. Like you have objection tokens that you can only spend. You have 3 of them, and you can only spend them once each for the entire trial. It's when someone else plays an argument card, you can turn over one of your objection cards to have them discard it, and they have to discard it immediately and play another card. Mm. You can. There's certain abilities and effects that will come out based on the judge's favor at that time. So the judge will either favor, at any given time, they will favor the prosecution or the defense, and you can manipulate that with cards, or you can. There's one token called a sidebar token, which is effectively the thematic act of, you know, calling a sidebar and talking to the judge and having them, you know, doing something in favor. So you can use your sidebar token to bring the judge's favor to you. And sometimes some of the cards you want to play, if they'll have an action on those that will only trigger if the judge is in your favor at that time. So you want to try and ensure that you've got the judge's favor before you play those cards. So yeah, so it's a cool little game. It's a lot going on, and like I said, there's 12 tug of war tracks back and forth and back and forth. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Listening to you talk about that reminded me of Watergate. Where you have one single tug of war track and you try to sway the evidence, you know, towards the Nixon administration side or the publisher, the newspaper publisher side.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wanted to say about this is that, to me, it seems to be a very good mechanic for people that do not like direct conflict.
Mm.
So there's people like my wife doesn't like direct conflict games where there's combat or you lose things instead of building them and things like that.
Mm.
And yet, I think these kind of games that have a tug of war where you try to, you know, pull it to your side or not lose as much to the other side, they are a great mechanic for people that don't like these direct conflict games because it doesn't feel like you're attacking the other person. It doesn't feel like a direct conflict against that. It has this intermediate place where you're trying to pull the rope on your side a little bit. So I think that mechanic would work really well in those situations. So I'm excited to try it now that you've described it.
There is a little bit of take that with the objection tokens because you can, like, if someone plays a big card and you think, oof, that's a lot of influence right there, you can, well, I object to that. Like, you flick your token over and they've got to discard it straight away. But you can only, and this is like the thematics of it as well, you can only object to their argument cards. So each of the cards will be classified as a particular type of card. So there's like argument, there's evidence, there's procedures, there's, you know, other things based on which case you're doing. So if it's evidence, we can't object to evidence because evidence is evidence. Yeah. Yeah. If it's a procedure, you can't object to a procedure. It's a procedural issue, right? But if they're just making an argument, well, you can object to the argument, yeah. and you can only do it three times.
Yeah. yeah.
So
is it a quick game?
There's differing lengths.
Okay.
So each there's two cases that come in the base game, but within each case, there's a whole bunch of different variations.
Right.
That you can choose. So yeah, and the variations essentially are the different game lengths. So depending on how much time you've got, you can say, oh, yeah, let's play one of the quick ones. The box says 60 minutes on average.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So it's like the games I've played, we've had 8 witnesses in total. So you're essentially playing the back and forth 8 times
mm-hmm.
Throughout the course of the game. And once all the witnesses are done, then you just add up the each of the tracks and where they're at, and yeah, that's how you determine your winner.
Fair enough.
Well, one other bonus, and I could be wrong. I haven't checked this yet. I keep saying I'm going to go check, but I remember when it was on Kickstarter that I was really iffy about it. I was kind of flip flopping for ages about whether I was going to jump on it or not. And the reason that I was kind of leaning towards the not was because it was strictly 2-player game.
Yeah.
And there was no solo mode, and everybody knows that I'm very, you know, dependent on solo modes in games, and to the point where I will avoid some games entirely just because they don't have one. But this one, I thought it's good enough. It's, you know, it looked good enough to me. It's a different theme that you don't see all the time. It's got that uniqueness to it, and that's what sort of drew me in and got me over the line. And then as I was reading through the rules and I got to the end and you know, how you work out who the winner is, I noticed on the next page it says solo mode.
All right.
yeah.
There you go.
So I don't know if they snuck that in there as a stretch goal that I missed or if that was already always planned and they didn't communicate it, or I just flat out missed it and didn't read it. Mm. But this is, I guess, one for the ages. I haven't tried it solo yet.
Yeah, right. I might have to, because I'm keen to play it. And I don't know if I'll get it to the table this week with anyone else. So,
yeah,
I'm keen. You're right. This theme isn't done very often, which is odd because in movies, this is like trotted out every second movie. You know, So it's interesting that board games haven't followed that path. So,
Well, I guess it could be seen by some as a bit of a boring theme, bit of a dry thing. And if done poorly, it could turn into a bit of that. Drawn out. Yeah.
Mm. Well, there we go. Lawyer up. So that was all of our sizzles. We'll finish the segment there, and we'll move on to our topic. So the topic of the week this week, I've done it. Look at that, twice in a row, man. Mitch, you said a good little game too when you were talking about
Lawyer Up.
No, I think you said about Too Many Bones, actually.
Oh, did I?
Yes.
Yeah, so, jeez, good little game.
Yeah, so a few drinks for those who are playing the drinking game. But the topic of the pod on this episode, that's a bit clearer, is theme in games. We actually spoke a little bit about theme in the games we were just talking about there, but we're probably talking more about how necessary a theme is, or whether a theme can get you across the line on whether you buy or don't buy a game, and those sort of things. So my opinion on theme, just straight off the bat, is that I think it's becoming more important than it used to be in games.
Hmm.
And that goes along with the territory of there being more games being released these days, that, you know, how are you setting yourself apart more than anything else? So if I've got a game that is, an abstract game that has a not a great link to theme, or I have a game that's really story driven and, you know, you can really immerse yourself in that story, then that sounds more enjoyable having not played either game to me.
Mm.
It may not be that way after playing both games, but definitely on the initial, I feel like that to me has become more important.
Mm. Yeah, I think theme plays a big part. I was gonna make a joke and say I'm not interested in theme after talking about Lawyer Up in the courtroom. theme means nothing. No, but I definitely think for me, theme is a big factor in it. But as I sort of sit here and ponder this topic and think about, you know, concentrate and do some internal sort of thought process into what I do take away from theme, it's a strange one because I do think that I get pulled in initially by the theme, definitely. Mm. But at the same time, I really like if it's an abstract game with no theme whatsoever, I'll still really enjoy those too. I can, you know, they can be just as good and they can be really entertaining. But the funny thing is the space in between that, I don't like.
Mm. Okay.
I have said, this game was okay, but the theme is just, might as well not be there. It's wasted. You know, it's just painted on, you hear that all the time. So it's almost like if you're not going to do a really good job as a theme, don't do it at all.
Yeah.
You know? It's a bit of a strange one, and that's me. You know, I'm happy to put my hand up and wear that strange label. Maybe I am a weirdo. But, I either like really well done theme, which will pull me in and totally get me sucked into enjoying the game, or like, for example, I think Everdell is the one that jumps out for me, which, you know, has great art, great world built around it, great story, and I really enjoy that game. I know that a couple of weeks ago I argued against it for the battle. But it is a really good game. I've bought everything. I think it was one of the first games that I decided that I was just going to get everything. I didn't care how long it was going to take. It was just going to be an all-in sort of thing for me. But the times I've played the game hasn't really – like, it's good. It's a good game and I enjoy it, and I will play it when anyone asks me to play it. But it's not my top 10.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yet if you said to me, which is the – thematically, like, which theme and story and world – do you think is the best that could be up there?
Very good.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think why, you know, because I feel the same way. I feel that theme is becoming more important, and I'm trying to figure out why that is. And the way I think about theme is, you know, there's two places for it. One is, and this could be the reason why it's becoming more important, one side is the more complex games, the heavier games that are getting designed, I think they rely on theme to make them more approachable, to make them easier to teach, to make them easier to learn, to make sense when you play them. And when we spoke to Vital Lacerda in one of our previous episodes for an interview, we asked him the question, and he said, because we wanted to know how does he design these games, right? And he said, well, I don't worry about the design. I just do a lot of research on the theme firstly. And I think this is why some of these games, even though they're quite heavy and complex, they're actually pretty straightforward to play once you get into them, because they're so the theme interconnects so well with the mechanics that they make sense to you. And if it is something that has been researched, then it helps you play the game. It may not, you know, drive you through it. It may not immerse you in a different world, but it just explains the game better for you. It clicks better in your brain. So that's one side. But the other side is heavily immersive games, right, where the theme is the game in a way. It's what drives the mechanics. It's what you expect to come out of your play. It's what gives you the satisfaction of playing that game. And I have heaps of examples on both sides. So I think it is becoming more important, but for different reasons on each side, you know. I do think, though, at the end of the day, that a good design in a game without a theme or pretty bad done theme will survive a lot more plays than a game that has fantastic theme but a poorly written mechanics or design or whatever else. So I feel it's getting more important, but mostly in the sense of improving well-done games, not, you know, creating that out of thin air just with the theme.
Mm. I think you nailed it where you said that the theme helps you play the game and helps you understand it. I've played a – you can tell the difference between those, you know, a really well-designed game because of that. Because you sort of go, oh, look at all these rules, and it seems a bit overwhelming. But then when you just start getting into the theme, you go, well, yeah, okay, that's next, and, yeah, that goes to that. Ooh. And that makes sense because that's the whatever it is, and the whatever it is does that. So that makes sense, you know, and it all sort of it supports the rules almost and helps you play. I think you nailed it, Def.
It's interesting, though. I find personally that theme is a selling point for me. And I base that on the fact that although I enjoy abstract games, I never want to play them. So games like Gear Azules and Splendors, even Calico, for example, like they're abstract games and they're good puzzles and I enjoy them. But I never go to my shelf and go, yes, I want to play Calico. Like I always... It's almost – it's always someone else that says, oh, let's play this game. I'm like, yeah, cool. Let's play that. So theme is a seller for me. But at the same time, when I teach a game with theme, I always forget to teach the theme. So like perfect example is the game day. I taught three games. I taught Dwellings of Eldivale, Smartphone Inc., and Orléans. And I'll get to Dwellings and Smartphone in a minute, but – Orléans is a perfect example of a game that if it came out today would have a stronger tie to its theme. But because it's 8 years old, it doesn't really have that. And it was interesting because as I was teaching the game, I had to stop myself and go, I'm going to go and look at the book and actually tell you the names of these things because I'm just calling them, you know, the blue chip, the red chip, the black chip, you know, and they've got their pictures on there. And then, so we're doing all this and we're playing the game and about halfway through, one of the guys says, so, but who are we? And I'm like, you know what? I've played this game over 20 times and I don't actually know how to answer that question. I don't know who we are. I know that we go and do these things and it's kind of fun. So that's an example of, like, I think if 8 years removed, if they were to redo that game, it would they would make that stronger. They would make that better. Whereas in
the game would be better off for it, right?
100%. Yeah, that's right. Because you look at a game like Smartphone, right? I love that game. You can't teach Smartphone without teaching that theme. You know, why can't I put my thing there? Because that person won't pay that much for your phone. That's the only way to answer that question. There's no, you can't, it's not like you have to apply the mechanics to the theme. The mechanics are the theme. So you can't teach that game without actually teaching the person what they're doing and why it's important that they're doing it. And I think that's been a big shift in the last sort of few years with games. It's not so much, let's take this mechanic and stick a theme on it. It's like, let's make this theme a board game.
And I
was just looking at your shelf, Mitch, behind you, and I noticed a game that matches what Steve just said perfectly. You know, I've played this game quite a few times, and that's Role Player, which is not an abstract game like Azul. It has this whole theme behind it, but it's almost like it's been, you know, it doesn't drive the mechanics. It's a puzzle, right? You build your stats for your character. It's a very fun puzzle, very engaging. I love it. But you can almost separate it completely from the theme. You don't really pay
could
attention.
Be any character
could
anywhere.
Be anything. Could be, you know, anything. And then you've got those other games that the theme drives everything, the narrative, the mechanics, the actions. And I think we're moving towards that a lot more, and people get, you know, identify with some of these things easier now because you can get any type of theme and make something creative out of it and then create the mechanics behind it.
It's funny you should bring up, you say, in the teach with the Smartphone Inc., Steve, because I had a similar experience with a game that you may assume doesn't have a great deal of theme at first sort of glance, just by the nature of the game, which is Hadrian's Wall.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's a flip and write. So you're looking at cards and you're moving resources around, you're crossing boxes off on a piece of paper, right? So you might sort of say, well, there's not a lot of theme going on there. What's happening? But I did notice during the teach yesterday that actually explaining the game in a thematic sense as opposed to a game sense and a mechanic sense helped people learn the game better and makes more sense in terms of teaching that than the other way around. Mm. For example, one of the sort of complex sort of things in the game is that you have a fort, a wall, and a sippy.
The wall, yeah.
And the fort is essentially the base of your wall, and then you have the wall, and the sippy is like your, your barbed wire and your bits of rocks and glass or whatever else you're putting in the top to finish it off. So in the game, mechanically, you cannot complete sections of the wall and the sippy until you've completed sections of the fort. To represent that on the game, on the sheet, there's little chain icons that will chain those other sections to the fort so that you know, oh, this is chained to the fort. You need to pay attention to the fort before you can do this. Mm-hmm. But, you could explain them to that by doing that saying, oh, you see these chains there. But it's easier to say to them, your fort is your foundation. You can't build the second part of your wall until the foundations for your wall are down. And then you can't finish the sippy until the wall's completed because the sippy goes on top of the wall. So then, when you explain it like that, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Of course, you got to have your foundation first, then you put a wall on, then you put your sippy on top of the wall. So even beyond that, you have granaries. So you have a small granary that you start off with, and then you have, as you grow, you can build a medium granary and a large granary. And again, you can only advance your tracks a certain distance when you only have a small granary.
Mm.
So, when I explained it, I said, your small granary is only going to support a certain number of troops.
Mm.
If you want to build more troops out across here and your reinforcements and whatever, and your cohorts and your defenses, well, you need to build a bigger granary in order to feed all those people. So until you build your bigger granaries, you can't advance any of these tracks any further because your small granary will only feed this many of your army. So it just
and the other one, people. Yeah.
And the other one, Def, was the disdain that you get, which are the negative points.
Ah, yes.
That you can remove the disdain, but in order to do that, you have to visit the baths to bribe the city officials.
That's right.
To remove your disdain and get your reputation restored, right? So, rather than saying, oh, go over to the green section and tick off the boxes with the gold hands, saying, oh, to get your reputation fixed, you've got to head to go and grease up the palms of the officials in the baths. So definitely theme, even in a roll and write like that, that's a heavy roll and write that can be hard to remember everything and, figure where everything goes and what's going on where. Using the theme to support the mechanics is critical, and it's really effective.
Yeah. There are exceptions to the rule, though. Like, one of my favorite games is Space Base. That game has just got no theme. That could be called Bicycle Race and it wouldn't make a difference. It's funny because there's actually an expansion, which is a campaign, and I'm like, why? Why would you make a campaign expansion to Space Base? It doesn't make any sense at all. Because I played that game in excess of 30 times, and I couldn't tell you what one card is named. Like, not one. And when it's really hard because if you need to seek, especially when you've only played it a couple of times, if you need to seek clarification on a card, you've got to go and read the name of the ship that's on the card. And they're all like proper, like long names. They're like, they are thematic names, theoretically. That just makes it hard to find what you're looking
solution.
For. Yeah, that's right. there's definitely that would be my big glaring exception to the rule where the theme I could care less. Yeah. Well, we might end up the conversation of theme there. Or is there anything else that you guys want to mention before we move on?
No, I think we've covered it off pretty well.
Yeah. Yep. Nice clean, concise topic for today. All right, with that then, we'll move on to the Board Game Barbecue Bracket Battle 2.0. I'm going to say the full title of that for every segment for the next 59 battles or whatever is left. Okay, so before we get to the new battle that we're announcing, we're resolving the previous battle, which was A War of Whispers versus the Board Game BBQ 2020 Game of the Year co-winner, Gloomhaven Jaws of the Lion. So that should tell you how this vote went, right? Like, you've got a Game of the Year up against a not Game of the Year, although then again, War of Whispers didn't come out in 2020, and we didn't exist in 2019, so who knows? But what do you guys think? How do you reckon this one went down?
It's hard to say.
I think it went down bad for Jules. This is what I think.
I think it would have been closer than what we originally thought, but I think at the end, Jaws of the Lion would still win that.
Yeah. When you look at Jaws of the Lion and the meteoric rise that it had, what was it? It was 2020, and it's already at number 6 on BGG's all-time list, right?
Insane, yeah.
It has just flown up there. So if popularity has anything to do with it, and if our community is any sort of representative subsection of the greater board gaming community, I would think that Jaws of the Lion probably got there.
Yeah, I honestly don't see a way that this doesn't surpass Gloomhaven on the BGG rankings.
Oh, it definitely will, yeah. I agree.
Because most people who play Gloomhaven prefer Jaws of the Lion. They don't like to admit it, but they generally do. Jaws of the Lion did win, and it was comfortable. It won on all four platforms. It was 148 to 56. So about 3-1.
Yeah. That's even bigger drubbing than Fleet got.
Yes. So there we go. So Jaws of the Lion goes through to round 2.
That means Fleet's better than War of Whispers, just for the record.
Only if Everdell's better than Gloomhaven, by that logic. But anyway. all right. So we need to set up the next one. And whoa, what a bizarre coincidence. Def and Mitch, I think you two like these games that we're battling tonight. Like, or maybe one of you likes one and one likes the other somehow randomly.
How did that happen?
No, it's like we've scheduled this or something. It's
like the gods of chance are working against us.
All right. So you guys are going to do your best to battle for Great Western Trail versus Aether Fields.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is going to be another belter round one battle.
I've only got 3 words to say. Cute little cows.
Come on. I thought your 3 little words were going to be dun, 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 Great Western Trail.
I mean, cows versus dreams. Yeah.
I often dream about cows, so that's the same thing, isn't it?
What? Hashtag worst bracket battle ever.
Is there a better thing to do than dreaming about riding across the Western Plain, heading out to Kansas City with all your cows in tow that's going to score you heaps of money in the bank?
Yeah, but you're dreaming about that. That's the magic of it. You have to dream about it.
But in Aether Fields, my cows are going to turn into some sort of 3-headed aliens, aren't they?
Yes, 100%.
And attack me.
Yep. That sums it up.
All right, so we're going to have to do this the way we always do it. So I'm going to go with the older game first. So Mitch, Great Western Trail, you get a time to tell everyone why it's better than Aether Fields.
Look, I can't tell you why it's better than Aether Fields because I haven't played Aether Fields. But what I can tell you is Great Western Trail is a fantastic game. It's a perennial all-star. It is a bit older than Aether Fields, and the staying power that it's shown since it was released is just a testament to how good this game is. Next year or later this year? I don't know, soon. It's not too far off. They're actually doing a re-release of Great Western Trail where they're adding a bit more content. They're adding a solo mode. And then following on from that, there's going to be, I think, 3 more spin-offs where they do other countries and other livestock as well. So it's building its own franchise. That's how good this game is. It's an Alexander Pfister design, and he is phenomenal. He's done a lot of other games that have all been highly regarded, and this is his piece de resistance. I don't think he's French, though. but, yeah, it's just a really great game. It's got a lot of different mechanisms in it. There's some card deck building. There's a rondel system with the actions and the buildings that you can make. And there's some action point tracks and things that you push along when you're pushing along to get your victory points. So it's just a really good game, lots to it and lots of fun. And, I'll continue to play it.
Just before I go to Etherfields, I just need to point out that when we record, we have our video up as well, so we can like have visual cues and whatnot. And while Mitch was talking about his piece de resistance, Def could not have looked any more disinterested in what you were saying.
I think
I was actually looking dreaming. Up. Yeah, I was dreaming. I was actually looking up my stats to see how many times I've played this bizarre game, and it's even lower than I would have thought. But
tell us why Etherfields is better then.
I've played both games. Etherfields I've played in excess of 40-45 times now. Wow. So that's all you need to know, right? And I don't usually play thematic games. Great Western Trail is a good game. I don't want to, argue there at all. I do think it's not Pfister's best. Maracaibo, for me, is the much better design. Mitch is shaking his head. He's now giving me the finger. So Etherfields, for me, is extremely unique, and I think this is why I would vote for it to go through this round. It's doing something that has not been done before in board games. It has this fantastic world-building around the characters who are the dreamers, and you all of a sudden find yourself in a dream, and you don't even remember who you are, and part of the story is picking up bits and pieces to remember things about your identity through these dreams. So that is extremely unique. And the other thing is that it is so immersive. It sucks you in ways that I've never experienced in a board game before. And the topic itself gave the designers this freedom to come up with so many unique puzzles in the game. So each dream is like a puzzle that you have to explore and solve, and they all work in a completely different way. Some of them are about exploration, some of them are about efficiency, some of them are about unlocking different things. Some have moving map tiles that escape from you when you try to reach them. It is so unique that it has, taking away so much of my time without even giving it a second thought. Etherfields all the way.
All right, have you got a retort there, Mitch?
Look, I like Def, and I like, I think that his description and his portrayal of Etherfields is nothing to be scoffed at. It sounds like a great game. Unfortunately, it will be missed when it drops out of the bracket battle against dun diddle dun diddle dun diddle Great Western Trail.
Fair enough. There we go. Trying to swoon you to vote for his game. Def, have you got a song for Etherfields?
No, I don't have a song, but everybody that will go to sleep tonight will have to dream about something, and this game will send you there every time you play it, so...
All right, well, it's up to you now. You get to vote on which of these two games you think deserves to go through to round two of the Board Game Barbecue Bracket 2.0. You can do that in four places. You can go to our Board Game Barbecue Facebook community, and then you'll be able to vote there with the emojis for the game that links, the emoji that links with the game that you would like to vote for. Probably made that sound more difficult than it needed to be. You can go to Instagram on the Instagram story and vote there, as well as the Facebook story that'll come up from the Board Game Barbecue. And then you can also go to the Bracket Battle channel on our Discord and vote there as well. It'll be interesting to see how this one goes, because a lot of people got Etherfields delivered this year. So there was a bit of a big push for it mid-year. Unfortunately, I was one of those silly people who didn't do the split shipment. So I still haven't gotten my copy of Etherfields. I have played Great Western Trail, and I did quite like it. In fact, one of the things I enjoyed the most about that game, Mitch, is that the way that the game end triggers, how you kind of control mm-hmm. that, because if you hire the people, then that pushes, speeds up the game. Yeah, like
pushes the tracker off the board. The quicker, the more you hire, the quicker it goes. Yeah,
yeah, I thought that was really cool.
It is very cool.
So, yeah, get out there and vote. And with that, we'll finish the bracket. Actually, before we finish the bracket, it needs to be mentioned that we have a sponsor for the Board Game Barbecue bracket this year, and that is none other than Game Toppers, who still currently have a Kickstarter open until I think Thursday or Friday Australian time. So we actually got the pleasure of playing on a Game Topper at the Sydney Game Day, which was really cool. It's quite a sturdy piece of equipment, that's for sure. Probably more sturdy than I expected it to be, probably because it weighs a little bit more than I expected it to weigh. I say that. Like, we did joke about it, how it's like it is a portable thing, but it is certainly not an easy-to-carry thing. It's got handles on both sides. A two-person carry is totally fine. A single-person carry is a bit of work. That being said, what the byproduct of that is, when you put it on the table, we had this sitting on two or three tiny little round tables.
Like bar tables.
So not even like a proper table. And it was super sturdy. Like, we had six people sitting around it, all with our arms on the sides of it. It was never moved. You never noticed the seam in the middle. Didn't seem to come up at all. You just throw a playmat on and away you go. So, I quite liked it, and I'm not saying that just because they're a sponsor. I actually quite liked them. So did you get a chance to play on that table, Mitch?
I did indeed, yeah. And when we were setting it up with those little tables, I thought we might have some liability issues for when that thing fell off and crushed someone's foot. but it didn't look like it, not for a second.
Yeah, and when we pulled it down, like at the end of the night when we unpacked it, a lot of people were like, oh, wow, it was on that? They were shocked that we had it sat on that. So, that's as good as you can probably get one of those things, I think. So check it out. They are delivering to Australia, and we'll have it at the Brisbane Game Day as well. And we'll have some accessories with it there. So hopefully we'll be able to look at how they work. But with that, we'll finish up the bracket and we'll head to our final segment of the night, which is Swearing an Oath. So Swear an Oath segment is brought to you by Dean at Advent Games. Well, Advent Games, I should say. But big shout out to Dean. It was great to actually meet him in person because up until this point, I've only spoken to him on the phone or via email. But Dean was at the game day with his store, and he was just a lovely man. Great to chat with. He was really good. He taught a few games and always had a smile on his face. Been a sponsor of the show for a very long time. So big shout out to Dean and Advent Games. Go and check out their website. It's a great store, great online store. But with that, it's oath time. So who would like to go first with their oath tonight?
Well, Mitch has left, so I will go first. So my oath was to, oddly enough, play Too Many Bones with Mike. Now, I haven't played with Mike. I could pretend that I've invited him 18 times and he declined, but I've actually played the game 18 times on my own, so I really hope that covers the oath.
You don't have to say anything. You don't have to say anything else, Def. It's Mike's fault.
Yeah, okay. There you go.
I'm going with that. I blame Mike.
Yeah.
You're in the clear.
There you go. Thank you. So that was my oath. Whether I've done it or not, I'll leave it up to you guys. Too many bones.
All right, so what's next?
What's next is interesting. Initially, I was going to go with some kind of ridiculous number of plays for one of my games based on this, you know, trend I've had of repetitive plays the last few weeks. But I actually think I'm going to do an oath for a game I haven't played yet, which is Cooper Island. I think from the games that I've got unplayed, it's the one that's been sitting there the longest. And I don't have many of those in the first place. I've only got about five or six of them. So I think I will choose that as my next oath. So Cooper Island.
Oh, nice one. I'm going to go to you next, Mitch, because you look like you're desperate to talk about this.
Oh, sorry, guys. The phone's ringing. I've got to just give me... So my oath, the previous one that I had, I don't know if you could recall, Steve, but it was a little bit of a strange one. So I was in a bit of a conundrum over whether or not I should bust my Railroad Ink.
That's right. Yeah.
The green and the yellow boxes.
You had to listen to Connor. That was your oath.
That was the oath, to listen to Connor, right? To see if Connor was going to give me the advice to keep it or to sell it. And he went off and he played them all and he sent me some photos, but he didn't send me any comments or anything. And I said, so what's the deal? Should I?
What's the verdict?
What's the verdict? You know, my oath is riding on this. And he said, you'll have to wait till I'm on the show next. And he hasn't been on the show.
So what you're saying is you've gotten off scot-free here.
So what I'm saying is I'm blaming Connor and Mike. I'm blaming Mike for Def's oath, and I'm blaming Connor for my oath. And that's where I'm going to leave it.
Solid.
So, I have not progressed my Railroad Ink oath, but when next Connor is next on the show, then I'll make the decision based on that. It is still sitting here, for those of you that can see me.
Oh, yeah.
It is still sitting there on the shelf, boxed up, ready to go.
You did try to sell it to me.
I did.
So there is that.
That's true. That's just an indication of how much faith I have in Connor.
Oh, boy.
Wow. Well, I think it's only fair then that you swear another oath.
So I will swear another oath, and I'm going to include in my next oath what I think is one of the current hotnesses that's going around. And I say that because this game was present at the game day yesterday, and it went gangbusters. And I think if we checked with Dean, I think if we checked with Dean, he brought about 15 copies, and I think they were gone by the time the end of the day rolled around. Okay. And then when he walked in and I saw him unpacking them, I said, I got dibs on one of those. I said, if you sell everything else, the last one is mine and you know, you have to put it aside for me. He was like, yep, no problems at all. And I think I got the last one. I did play it yesterday, not my copy of it, but I played the copy that was there. And I played with Brad, my son. And he loved it as well. He smashed through about three cases. And that game is Micro Macro Crime City.
Okay.
Which Sarah talked about as her season game, I think, on the last episode or the episode before.
Yeah.
Which is, big kind of puzzle, find the hidden item in this giant map game. So it's kind of like a cross between Where's Wally and Cluedo.
That's a good way of putting it, yeah.
times 100 on steroids.
On steroids, yeah. Have a drink.
Brad is jazzed about it. So what I'm going to make the oath is to say that I, Mitch Keddie, will play Micro Macro Crime City, and I will rope into the game my other two kids and hopefully my wife to have a big family game of this before I am on the podcast next.
Fantastic.
It's my copy's waiting for me when I go back to my regular gaming night. It's I bought it straight after listening to Sarah talk about it. It was I bought it through 2D6, but I can't wait any longer. And then I got down, and then couldn't go to the game night last Thursday, so I was down at Sydney and I saw it there. I'm like, oh, I could have just bought it here and I'd have it now.
You'd have it now, and you could put it on your shelf and in shrink.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Did you have a go yesterday when it was there?
I didn't. I had a look. I didn't have a chance to have an actual crack at it. But I already knew I was going to love it. And then I looked at it and I'm like, this is great. This is excellent. And I brought my daughter over and showed her. And although she always tries to feign interest on anything board game related, it caught her. It piqued her interest. She was looking at it. And so I think that'll be a win. My last oath, I actually said on the last episode that I definitely will not. Oh, I didn't say it definitely was. I'm pretty certain I won't get this done before this episode, which was to play Parks with my family.
Oh, yes.
because the episode came out Thursday, and then on Friday I flew to Sydney and I got back today. So, and obviously didn't get a chance to play with my family. So Parks is still my oath. It'll carry over to the next episode. And I'm going to add something. It's not a game, but I'm just going to add something that I haven't done yet and I feel like I need to do. And that is that I, Stephen Chivers, swear to unbox Nemesis.
Whoa. Yes.
It's just sitting there staring at me. This huge box is still in my garage. So I'll unbox that. I'll take some photos, or I might do a video if I can. Either way, I'll try and get a play in, but I'm not going to swear to do that because it is a long one and it's weeknights from now until the next episode. So, but I'll definitely crack it open and I'll definitely try and get Parks to the table as well. So there we go.
Good stuff.
Did you get the Sundrop minis?
Yes.
I'm keen to see those, to see how good they are.
This is the thing. I've been so keen to open them, but every time it's time to do it, it's like 11 o'clock at night. And I'm like, this is going to be like a 2-hour process because I'm just going to be looking at them and going, oh, these look so good. it's going to be an experience, I think, just opening the boxes. All right. Is that all of our oaths?
That's it.
Wow. Look at that. Look at us go. How efficient are we?
We are like seasoned veterans right here.
Yeah, that's it. Back at the start, like I've talked about this before, but when we first started this podcast, we said we want to try and aim our episodes to be between 40 and 60 minutes. And the first episode was 60 minutes and like 5/100ths or something. It was just over 60 minutes. And it was like, oh, it's too long. And I think Mitch, you made the joke, oh, I'm not going to listen to that. That's way too long. Ha ha ha. And aside of the special Jamie Stegmaier episode where it was only the interview with him and our Board Game Barbecue Awards, I don't think there's been a single episode under an hour and a half in 103 episodes.
Until now.
Until now. It might have something to do with it. Mitch and I was up until the AMs playing board games in Sydney yesterday.
Pretty rare.
Either way, thank you very much for listening, everyone. That is the end of the show, and we'll catch you. First, I'm going to say big thank you to Def and Mitch.
No worries.
Always a pleasure. It was good fun.
Very fun.
And we will catch you on episode 105, and I'm pretty sure we'll have a special guest on that one too, so stay tuned.
Adios.
Cheers.